The opening prayer for today is from Psalm 28, verses 6 through 9. Blessed be the Eternal, because he has heard the voice of my supplications. The Eternal is my strength and my shield. My heart trusted in him, and I am helped. Therefore my heart greatly rejoices, and with my song I will praise him. The Eternal is their strength, and he is the saving refuge of his anointed. Save your people, and bless your inheritance. Shepherd them also, and bear them up forever. Amen. Shabbat Shalom. Greetings from Central Florida, a warm, sunny, I guess you could say hot, Central Florida. I'm in a merry frame of mind because I had the opportunity to perform a wedding yesterday. They were not members of God's church, but they could be described as ethical monotheists within the Abrahamic heritage. So we had a very interesting time. We have now completed a month counting, 4 weeks counting towards Pentecost. Is that true? We have, right, yeah, we're 28 days have gone by, right, in counting towards, well, this is the 28th day in, 35, that sounds better. 35 days have we've finished counting towards Pentecost. That's 5 weeks, 5 weeks. So there are 2 weeks to go, 15 days to go to the 50th day. Today is day 35, counting towards Pentecost. We're going to talk about events that occurred around this time of year, a bit earlier, but around this time of year, in just a moment. I call this talk A Divine Visit to a Friend. A Divine Visit to a Friend. In this culture, we have to be very careful when we want to be the proverbial Good Samaritan because of just the nature of the world in 2014 on the Roman calendar, you know, the world as we know it. But still, there are principles to follow in terms of being helpful, in terms of being hospitable. The principle is still there. We have to be careful how we apply the Bible verses. We have to be wise. We have to put all of the verses together. But there is one passage in the scripture I want to start with, a fascinating passage, and this is in Hebrews, the 13th chapter. Let brotherly love continue. Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by so doing, some have unwittingly entertained angels. You know, when Lot had those guests coming to him, he did not know, and he was trying to be helpful. He did not know initially that they were angelic beings. That's not what he took them to be. He found out, of course, that they were more than human by what they were able to do for him. But when he first wanted to be helpful and hospitable, he didn't know. He thought they were just two people in need. And we'll talk briefly about Lot, but my focus today is on Abraham. As you know, he's called in James 2, verse 23, Isaiah 41, 8, pardon me, he's called the friend of God. Abraham was the friend of God. And actually, God visited him in a very special way. He took on a human form and literally walked into his tent. Amazing. And he did that with two angels. So three spirit beings, including the great spirit, visited Abraham. Most amazing. You know, in the book of John, Jesus calls us his friends if we follow him, if we obey. You know, his friends are those, of course, who obey. We're trying to. In John 15:15, well, I'll go to the 14th verse because he defines his friends there. Abraham obeyed God, as you know, quite carefully. Look at Genesis 26:5. And speaking of Genesis 26:5, which was one of the verses I had to memorize back when I was in my 20s, I'm glad some of you have taken up the challenge to memorize a verse or two by Pentecost time. So, you know, right on. I'm glad you're doing that, some of you. Anyway, in John 15:14, you are my friends if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all things that I heard from my Father, I have made known to you. So he has said so much, taught them so much, taught us so much. And we want to learn more. We want to stay on friendly terms with God so that we'll learn more and more. And Abraham, because he remained on friendly terms with God, learned more and more. And he learned a lot from that divine visit I'm going to talk about today. Now we're, as I've said, we're between the days of unleavened bread and Pentecost. We begin counting towards Pentecost within the days of unleavened bread, as you know. I'd like to go to Genesis 19. When Lot entertained those angels. Let's notice what he does there. They come to Sodom. Now, I'm going to have some comments to make about Sodom today. Not a place you'd want to spend time in. Lot chose that area because at the time he chose it, it seemed like just a very blessed area, very prosperous area. But what sometimes happens to areas that are prosperous, you know, is that they deteriorate culturally, morally over time. And certainly that was the case in Sodom, and Lot was upset about it, as we read in the New Testament. But as upset as he was, for whatever reason, he didn't choose just to pull out of there. Now, I know it's not an easy thing to do that. He finally, of course, was pulled out, you know, for his own protection, as we know. But as bad as those people are in Sodom and Gomorrah, when we read about them, and they have become now proverbial, they will have their opportunity to repent in the right throne judgment period. They will have an opportunity to live perhaps a century and in a more positive environment, and to repent and to become spirit beings, to be born again, and then to be resurrected ultimately. They're going to have that opportunity once they've repented of the way of life they practiced back at the time I'm going to read about. And in Matthew 11, it is very scary what Jesus says to some people in his day. 11:23. Many of you have gone to the land of Israel in recent years. You've toured there. Of course, the Pope is there now. That reminds me of a story. I wasn't going to tell this story, but I think I will, because it just goes to show you what can happen when people get kind of carried away with end time prophecy. Not that we shouldn't be studying prophecy and praying for understanding. We certainly need it. And yes, in fact, a third of the Bible is prophecy. People have tended to get a little bit off the deep end when it comes to speculating about the end time. So I'm going to tell you a story that you're rarely going to hear. I'm speaking as an insider now, okay, an insider. Back in the 60s, I was in the ultra-Orthodox world, and there's a proverb among ultra-Orthodox Jews, at least there was back in the 60s. Maybe it's changed now. We live in a different age in some respects now, but let's go back to the 60s. You know that movie that asked you, where were you in 62? Anyway, let's go back to the 60s when some ultra-Orthodox Jews had to go to the bathroom. They would say, I'm going to visit the Pope. Now, I don't know. I can understand where that saying came from in a way. But anyway, they used to say, I'm going to visit the Pope, and they wanted to go to the bathroom. All right, well, here I am in Tucson, Arizona. I'm at the Festival of Tabernacles. And there's some member of the church had taken a tour of Israel, and they had just dedicated a new great synagogue there in Jerusalem, a new building, a new edifice. I believe in New Jerusalem, though. I believe in the western part, in the predominantly Jewish part of Jerusalem, not the biblical old city, but the new city. But they had built a beautiful great synagogue, there. And so for some reason, there was a lot of end time speculation among the, in the Bible Belt, somehow that this new great synagogue might be somehow the temple talked about in 2 Thessalonians, I guess. Well, anyway, so this church member is touring Israel. So she goes to this new synagogue and she asks somebody there, "What's that room over there for?" And so he told her, "That's for the Pope." And, evidently it was the men's room, you know. So anyway, she comes back to Tucson and she's all excited. And fortunately, I happened to be there, and she said, "What's going on here? You know, I asked this man, what's that room for in the synagogue?" And he said, "That's for the Pope." So I had to explain to her. It was a bathroom, is probably what, you know, why he said it. So anyway, that was a long time ago, but just thought you might be entertained by that story. Anyway, to go back to Matthew 11. And so anyway, some of you have visited the Holy Land and you've seen Capernaum and you've seen the ruins of an ancient synagogue, not the one where Jesus preached, but perhaps built on that site. And, you know, it's a more recent synagogue, very old, but yet, but maybe a century, younger than the one that he preached in. But anyway, so some of you have been there at Capernaum by the Sea of Galilee, and in Matthew 11:23, "And you, Capernaum, who are exalted to heaven, will be brought down to Hades," right? To the, what we might call in Hebrew, Sheol, you know, the abode of the dead. "You'll be brought down to Hades. For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. But I say to you that it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you." Imagine if you were in the, if you were in Capernaum hearing that. Wow, that's pretty scary. But you'll see the people in Sodom did have some lessons they needed to learn, and they had to learn them the hard way. And so we'll get to that in a moment. But first, let's get to something more positive. If we go back to Genesis, the 17th chapter, we have here Abraham, and you know his name is changed from Abraham, from Abram to Avraham. The fifth letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Hey, is added to his name. You know, you may remember that I talk about numbers, that when God reveals his love in the Bible, often he does it in multiples of five. In fact, today I'm reading from the five books of the law. Anyway, he added the fifth letter of the Hebrew alphabet to Abraham's name. And so Abraham went from Avram to Avraham. And speaking of the five books of the law, I believe right now in the synagogues, they're beginning their reading of the book of Numbers. As they go through the cycle from year to year, they read the Pentateuch through from week to week. I believe they're beginning now in the book of Numbers. I want to go back to something I covered last week to make it more clear, because I don't like to leave any loose ends or any people in confusion. So last week I talked about two people that were very important people. Is this clear, being seen clearly? How are my technician? Am I okay? Good. My one, the techie here. So we have Noach, or Noah. And so you see how his name looks in the Hebrew, Nun Chet. So a scholar would write N-O-A-H with a dot under the H, scholarly. A scholar, like if Dr. Finley is watching, a scholar would put a Dr. A with a dot under the H. But now you have Noah, Nun Ayin Hey, you know, and here you have the Hey at the end indicating a feminine ending, Noah. And that's Noah in the book of Numbers, which sometimes is spelled nowadays without the H. But in most Bibles, it's spelled with an H. But you see, it's not the same word. Here's Noach, and here's Noah. And what's interesting about this one, these names that they have, they mean the opposite. Noach means rest, comforting, and Noah has to do with movement. So they actually have opposite meanings. And in modern Hebrew grammar, we use those terms. We have a mark that we call the shva, which that term has come into linguistics. The word schwa is part of linguistics. It's the shortest vowel sound, like the E in delay. That's called a schwa. Well, we have in Hebrew the shva nach, you know, the resting schwa, or the one that is not pronounced, and the shva na, the mobile schwa, which is pronounced as the E in delay. So those terms actually have come into Hebrew, a modern Hebrew grammar, dikduk, as we call it. And I believe that there are English words of that sort, that there actually are some English words that maybe they have opposite meanings, and yet they may be spelled differently, but they may sound the same, and you have to be careful how you use them. But, you know, nothing came to my mind. I was trying to think of some example where you have two words in English that sound the same, but yet they are spelled differently and have opposite meanings. But I'll try to, maybe as time goes on, maybe I'll wake up in the middle of the night and think of one. You know, I have one that's not as dramatic is to say you are a gourmet or a gourmand, right? A gourmet is one who's so careful, eats just the best things and, you know, moderate portions so that you can enjoy all these different things. And a gourmand, you know, just pack it in, you know, and they're similar, similar terms. So that's kind of what I mean, but not quite as dramatic. Anyway, that's from last week, but it leads me, I can make a segue into this week. Noah was a man who was in a world which was also like Sodom. It was a world that was so bad that God wiped it out. In this case, in the case of Sodom, he exploded it out, burned it out, evidently. In the case of the flood, he drowned it out. But the rabbis sort of play games about Noah. They say, was Noah greater than Abraham or not? So some people say, well, Noah was righteous, and when the rest of the world was going to the dogs, for, you know, as we say in English, and so he was really great. Others say, well, he was righteous, but he was righteous in a world that was, you know, nothing, you know, no great shakes. So he was righteous in his generation, but not compared to Abraham. You know, so there's these, discussions. But Noah was, of course, the great man of his time, and he was in the 10th generation, as the Ethics of the Fathers points out. From Adam to Noah are 10 generations, and as you might have guessed, 10 generations then take us to Abraham, from Noah to Abraham. And so Abraham is the great man of his generation, and he is, of course, the father of all those who believe, as Romans tells us. The three great monotheistic religions of the Middle East come from Abraham: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And here in Genesis 17, Abraham is given a special requirement, as an indication of the relationship that he's going to have with God, but not only that he will have, but his descendants after him, and on and on and on. And so a male child is to be circumcised on the eighth day. Now, Abraham was too old to have that happen, so he had to do it at a very advanced age, and his whole household had that happen to them. But notice the promise that God makes. I'm in Genesis 17 now. Notice the promise that God makes to Abraham in the context of this circumcision requirement. Verse 15, then God said to Abraham, as for Sarah your wife, you shall not call her name Sarah. I'm sorry, as for Sarai your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. It just occurs to me that her name now also ends with Hay, although the Hay replaces a Yud. And I will bless her and also give you a son by her. Then she will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall be from her. And of course, ultimately, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords comes from her, as we know. Now, then Abraham fell on his face and laughed. And when you talk about Isaac, laughter seems to be associated with Isaac. You know, who ever heard of a 100-year-old man having a child with his wife about 10 years younger than that? Who ever heard of a 90-year-old woman getting pregnant? It's something to kind of laugh about, all right. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed. And this dramatizes the miracle of Isaac. It was a miraculous birth, and the laughter dramatizes that. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who was 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who was 90 years old, bear a child? And so, anyway, God said to him, I'm going to bless Ishmael. I'll take care of him. He'll be great. But the particular relationship I'm going to have is going to be with Isaac. Ishmael will be a great power, you know, and all the rest of it is there in the Bible. I have heard you. You know, Ishmael means God has heard. I've heard, you know, yes, I've heard you about Ishmael, but nevertheless, the promise will be through Sarah. Verse 21, but my covenant, verse 21, I will establish with Isaac, Yitzchak. You know, so he already gives his name in advance. Laughter is going to be the child that's going to be the covenantal child. And, of course, the book of Galatians goes through this in the fourth chapter at great length, the spiritual metaphor there. But anyway, verse 21, but my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. Oh, this set time next year. So there was a particular time when Isaac was to be born. And evidently it was the first day of unleavened bread, as we understand it now. Then he finished talking with him, and God went up from Abraham. So we have the promise, and we have the circumcision of Abraham. And the important, I want to focus on one important phrase here, you know, be'etzem hayom hazeh, in the bone of the day, the very essence of the day, or that self same day is translated. Let's see how the New King James handles it. Verse 23 of Genesis 17. So Abraham took Ishmael his son, all who were born in his house, and all who were brought with his money, every male among the men of Abraham's house, and circumcised the flesh of their foreskins, that very same day, as God had said to him. And it was that very same day that they left Egypt, 430 years later. And the book of Galatians talks about the 430 years from God's promise to Abraham to the Sinaitic covenant. But let's go to Exodus 12. As I said, it wasn't so long ago, 35 days ago or so, a little more. In Exodus 12 and verse 40, now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. Remember, they lived in Egypt, but their sojourn included more than Egypt. The sojourn of the Israelites, you know, who lived in Egypt was 430, including the time they spent in Canaan as well. And the Septuagint makes that clear. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years on that very same day. So it reminds you of Genesis 17, 23 that I read to you. On that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of the Eternal went out from the land of Egypt. So it would seem that he was circumcised on what became the first day of unleavened bread, and that Isaac was therefore born on the first day of unleavened bread. Anyway, we're now in Genesis 18. Then the Eternal appeared to him. So he's recovering now from the circumcision, and we're still there during the spring festival season. But we're not in the first day anymore, likely, because he's recovering from the circumcision. So we're keeping the festival. It's probably still early in the festival, but it's probably within the days of unleavened bread. And he's about 100, so he's recovering from the circumcision, and then God visits him. But let's go to Genesis 19, and we'll come back. But jumping ahead, you know, as you know, after God visited Abraham with the two angels, he sent the two angels on to go to Sodom. And when they come to Sodom, this is in Genesis 19. Just go one page in your Bible to Genesis 19. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. Very hospitable. This, of course, he got from Abraham, his uncle. And he said, "Hear now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet." Very much a theme in this springtime book of the Bible, you know, this foot washing. Wash your feet, then you may rise early and go on your way. So he's saying, look, I understand you're in a hurry. Maybe you don't want to stay long, but relax, wash your feet. You can get up early the next day, but rest, you know, have something to eat, rest, and then you can get up early and be on your way before it gets too hot, you know. And he said, "Hear now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise early and go on your way." And they said, "No, but we will spend the night in the open square." But that's not what you want to do in Sodom or anywhere, but, you know, especially not there. But he insisted strongly, so they turned into him and entered his house. And then he made a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. You know, you can't read this and not think the Bible is telling you that that was the season of the year when they did this. They did this at the time of year when in future years there would indeed be a feast of unleavened bread. Now, I would say the reason that they had unleavened bread is because he didn't anticipate he was going to have guests, I guess. So the guests come in, and so they give him something quickly, right? If you're making bread quickly, it doesn't have time to rise. So they gave him unleavened. They got unleavened bread. But you can see it's a Passover theme. It's a springtime setting. And so, in effect, we're thinking about the lessons of that festival as we read here. So very likely they leave Sodom. Lot is rescued from Sodom and leaves Sodom perhaps at the same time as the Israelites, perhaps across the Red Sea. This is my speculation. When the walls of Jericho fell was the seventh day of unleavened bread, when the Red Sea split, and possibly when Lot fled from Sodom. Anyway, let's get back now earlier in the festival to Genesis 18. So Abraham is at his tent. Ah, these are beautiful. In fact, I have used this example time and time again. So how foolish of me not to remember it. If you ever hear my talk on Jeremiah that I like to give, here's some English term. Like we have Noach and Noah, right? Noach the prophet, Noah the woman who stood up for her rights, along with her sisters, her four sisters. Anyway, we have raise, R-A-I-S-E, and raise, R-A-Z-E. The same sound, but a very different meaning. And I use this when I talk about Jeremiah. His name had both meanings, to raise and to raise, as we'll see one of these days when I talk about Jeremiah. And here's resend, rescind. They're pretty close. Resend, rescind, which is the opposite, right? And here's one. This is an interesting one because that's what Lot offered these angels. Succor, as we'll see. S-U-C-C-O-R. He offered them that. But on the other hand, sucker, is a very negative term when it's spelled S-U-C-K-E-R. Very good. So thanks a lot, My beloved Proverbs 31er came up with some great ones there. Okay. All right. So anyway, back to the story. So let's sucker these guests. S-U-C-C-O-R. So let's go to Genesis 18. And these guests are now going to be suckered by Abraham, who was the great author of hospitality, what we call in Hebrew hachnasat orchim, gathering in, bringing in the guests. I remember, it comes to mind, it's kind of funny, it comes to mind, there were these Vietnamese boat people, and now somehow the Israelis came across them. Maybe it was an Israeli ship in the Pacific Ocean. But in the 1970s, people were fleeing from Vietnam. I know a lot of you are listening from Southern California, so you know Westminster, Little Saigon. My son-in-law and daughter used to live near there in Huntington Beach. They used to live near Westminster, Little Saigon. And we have a Little Saigon here in Orange County, Florida. In Orlando, there's a very, so much smaller Little Saigon. Sometimes I have students that are Vietnamese. But anyway, these Vietnamese boat people were picked up by the Israelis, and they brought them to live in Israel. I suppose probably now a lot of them are managing restaurants over there. But anyway, Menachem Begin, the prime minister, said, "We're going to be as hospitable as our father Abraham." And so somebody wrote a letter into the Los Angeles Times and said, when my friend heard what Menachem Begin was doing, she said, "Isn't that Christian of him?" She got a kick out of that. Anyway, well, I'm going all over the place, aren't I? All right, let's focus on the passage here. Genesis 18. Then the Eternal appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. So he lifted his eyes, and behold, three men were standing by him. It's interesting how God chose to do this. He chose to visit him with two angels, three. The Bible talks about finality, revealing your will decisively in three steps, right? It's part of our culture in America. We say three times a charm. One, two, three strikes, you're out. It's part of our culture here in America. And, of course, Canadians play that sport as well. Well, they still play it all over now. Baseball's all over the place. But this three revelation, coming in three. And, by the way, I want to say one last thing about America, since I mentioned America. Some of you this week, what we call the weekend, in our popular culture, we'll have a three-day weekend. You'll have a long weekend because maybe you'll have a holiday on Monday if you're American. Monday in America, the last Monday in May in America, is Memorial Day. And so I want to honor those of you who have served in that way. And, of course, we honor the memory of those who have served in that way. My father is a deceased veteran of the Second World War. He served in the chaplaincy in General Patton's army, but he's not the one you see in the movie. If you ever saw the movie about Patton, there's this chaplain who writes to prepare for Patton. That wasn't my dad, no. But anyway, Memorial Day is coming up in America, so I wanted to mention that. Well, anyway, Abraham is here. So he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing by him. And so we understand that God reveals his will, you know, decisively in multiples of three. And we understand that God is one in three ways. That's the reality, right? He's three realities. The Greek term is, we say in English, an Americanized Greek, three hypostases, right? Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Anyway, so he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing by him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the ground. And first he addresses God. Now somehow, he knew this was God. They came in the form of men, and evidently he felt like, since they're coming as men, I'll treat them as if they were men, and they have, what would men need? Men would need to be cleaned up and rest and eat, and that's how he handles it. Besides that, the other two were angels, and I don't know if he exactly understood what angels, you know, can or can't do or whatever. So he treated them as he would treat human guests. But he comes before God first, and he says, "My Lord, if I have now found favor in your sight, do not pass on by your servant." And so he first addresses God. And then he goes on and says, "Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet." This "wash your feet" is for the group. If you look at the original Hebrew, "now wash your feet" is for the three of them. "And rest yourselves under the tree." Now, this really strikes me. This is a very powerful passage. Here Abraham washes the feet of Jesus Christ in a sense. This is God the communicator. This is God coming in human form. So it's the Logos. So we could say it's the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. And so he washes his feet. Now, Jesus Christ returns the favor later on when he comes to earth and he washes the feet of the disciples who were all descendants of Abraham. So he washes their feet in the Gospels around the same time of year. Moreover, it says, "Rest yourselves under the tree." You can't help but think about the execution stake, the cross. You know, Jesus Christ was in effect hung on a tree, as Galatians mentions, I believe the third chapter. You know, so, you know, the symbolism of here is so powerful. Wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. If you're a Christian, you can't get away from that symbolism, in my opinion. "And I will bring a morsel of bread." And you know what? It was probably unleavened. It doesn't say that here. But, you know, again, this was all done quickly. He wasn't expecting them. So very likely the bread was unleavened here. I mean, they couldn't go to Vons or Safeway or in this part of the country, Phillips or Albertsons, and just get bread. Anyway, and they still have Vons out there and Safeway, I suppose. Anyway, verse 5. "And I will bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh your hearts." The word for heart there is in the singular, so that you may refresh your strength, talking collectively, I believe. You know, it's your collective heart. The "your" is plural, and the heart is singular. So your strength, meaning the group, your heart metaphorically. "After that, you may pass by, inasmuch as you have come to your servant." They said, "Do as you have said." They said. So the three of them, God and the two angels, "Do as you have said." So they went ahead and they had taken on human form, and they were going to go ahead and do what people do, you know, rest and wash and eat. "So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, 'Quickly, make ready three measures of fine meal, knead it and make cakes.'" And of course, you know, she did it. You know, this was the relationship that they had. This was the kind of person Sarah was, you know. "And Abraham ran to the herd." Notice this. Ran to the herd. "Took a tender and good calf." He wanted the best for these guests. Well, of course, it's God, but he would have done this for human guests. That was his way, I believe. "And Abraham ran to the herd, took a tender and good calf, gave it to a young man, and he hastened to prepare it." I guess Abraham, you know, being as old as he was, he wasn't as spry as he would have been at an earlier time, so he let a young man handle this. Verse 8, "So he took butter and milk and the calf which he had prepared and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree as they ate." So he was there to see to their needs, like a waiter in a restaurant would serve your needs. That's the way a host should be. you know, solicitous for his guests. You have enough of this, you have enough of that, can I get you more of this? You know what I'm saying? And that's the kind of person Abraham was, very hospitable. And that's a very important trait that Christians are supposed to have. And Abraham sets the example here. I was going to comment on verse 8. I can't help it. If you go to the Queen Mary, a lot of you live in Southern California. I did a wedding yesterday. I did a wedding back in 1997, December 28th, 1997, in Long Beach. It was on the Queen Mary. It was my son-in-law, Doobie, and Rebecca, my daughter, Rebecca. And on the Queen Mary, if you tour the Queen Mary, I guess you can still do that, right? I hope so. I hope you can still go out to Long Beach and tour the Queen Mary. And you'll see on the Queen Mary that they have plates and cups. And they have kosher plates and cups. And the cups are labeled meat and dairy. And even the coffee cups are labeled meat and dairy. How could you have a meat coffee cup and a dairy coffee cup? Well, obviously the meat coffee cup cannot have true cream put in it. You have to have some substitute, whatever you're going to use, maybe some kind of powder. But even the powder, you got to be careful what powder you put in. It can't have enough dairy to be considered dairy. So sodium caseinate cannot be in it. If you look at products that have sodium caseinate, they may call themselves non-dairy creamer, but they will have a KD on the label for an Orthodox Jew. The Orthodox Jew will consider non-dairy creamer if it's got sodium caseinate to still be dairy. So let me backtrack and explain what I'm talking about. In the dietary laws of the Jews, the rabbinical dietary laws, there's a prohibition for mixing meat and milk together at the same meal. One cannot eat meat and milk together at the same meal. And not only that, but if you're very liberal, you can't have meat. I'm sorry, you can't have milk if you have had meat about an hour and a half ago. You still have to wait that long. Now, if you're liberal, if you're a little more conservative, you wait about 3 hours. So if you've had meat, you can't have like ice cream for about 3 hours. Now, if you come from Eastern Europe, that wait could be as long as 4 to 6 hours. If you're, let's say, a Lithuanian or Polish Jew, you would have waited 4 to 6 hours before you had your meat, your milk if you had meat. And you have to have, therefore, meat and milk. You have to have two sets of dishes in your home. El Al Airlines. Some of you have maybe flown El Al. El Al Airlines has two kitchens and on the plane. And most Jewish homes have a separate set of course, of pots and pans for dairy and a separate set of pots and pans for meat. And you go to the store and you buy products, and some of you are trying to buy kosher products because you want to be biblically kosher. You don't have to be rabbinically kosher, but you want to be biblically kosher. And so a lot of you buy kosher products, and you'll notice they're labeled not only kosher, but they're labeled D or M, if they're D or M. And the D is for dairy and the M is for meat. Now, some of you will notice that some products are labeled P, and the P products are parve, which is a Yiddish term. You can spell it P-A-R-V-E. It's a Yiddish term meaning neutral. I guess the Hebrew would be stami. And so these are neutral. They're not milk or meat, so you can have them with both. And so some Jews actually, when they buy a product, they'll look, oh, KP, that means I could have it with either. And some of you will see that on a product. You'll see the word P, your letter P, or maybe you'll even see the word parve, P-A-R-V-E. Maybe you'll even see it there. Is everybody with me? So why did I tell you all that? Because look, here's Abraham giving them buttermilk and a calf. You know, so I guess he wasn't rabbinically kosher. Well, the Jews have their way of reasoning about that. They say, well, you know, this was before Sinai. And there was another thing another reasoning that they do. I remember I told you that if you're an Orthodox Jew, you don't have milk if you've had meat before. However, it doesn't work the other way around. If I have milk, I can just wait just a short time and go ahead and have meat after. If I have my milk before, I can have my meat after. So the rabbis reasoned, well, he gave them butter and milk, pause, and the calf later. You know, so that's how they reason around that. So I thought that might be interesting to you. Anyway, biblically kosher, you can have a cheeseburger. Biblically kosher, it's fine. Which reminds me of a story. That's why I'm telling you that. There was a friend of mine who grew up a Catholic, I believe from Gary, Indiana. And he went to an archbishop because when he was becoming a member of the Church of God, obviously the Catholics wanted him to remain Catholic. And so he managed to have an audience with an archbishop, and the archbishop says, you know, if you try to become a legalistic Christian, a commandment-keeping Christian in the Old Testament sense, you wouldn't be able to eat a cheeseburger. Well, how could a person as educated as the archbishop have such a concept as that? Where's that in the Bible? You can't eat a cheeseburger. Well, because he read the Bible through the Jewish tradition. And so he evidently believed that the Bible prohibits eating milk and meat, which it does not. And so that's what this young man was able to tell the archbishop. Sorry, archbishop, I can be biblically kosher and still eat a cheeseburger. I don't know how else the discussion went. I don't know what else they talked about. All right, anyway. Verse 9, then they said to him, where is Sarah your wife? So he said, here in the tent. And he said, I will certainly return to you according to the time of life. And behold, Sarah your wife shall have a son. And even though he promised this before, still, you know, the reality of it, I guess, still hadn't really affected Abraham enough. Or maybe it had affected him, but Sarah, had not been there and heard it, I guess. Sarah was listening in the tent door, which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age, and Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Therefore Sarah laughed within herself, so, you know, the way you would do it, saying, after I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? You know, we're going to, let's say, you know, spice up our marriage, as one author put it, get the sizzle back, one woman wrote. I didn't make up that term. I think that's what the woman wrote. Back in the 70s, there was a craze, a fad. Somebody wrote a book called The Total Woman about wives being really, really sexy for their husbands. And they even had classes going for a while. I think that movement has died out, the Total Woman movement. But anyway, she was the term, I think, a woman that wrote about how Sarah had put sizzle back in her marriage. Anyway. Therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, after I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? Then Sarah said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I surely bear a child since I am old? Is anything too hard for the Eternal? See, that's why one of the reasons why this is in the Bible. This was a great miracle, but as you know, God showed us a greater one later on. Is anything too hard for the Eternal? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. So evidently, he didn't get her pregnant immediately, but afterwards, between what we would call during these days, between Passover and Pentecost, he got her pregnant, and then on the first day of unleavened bread, the next year, the child was born. Now, I'm not saying they were keeping those days, but I'm saying, on the calendar, what would have been the first day of UB is when Isaac was born the next year. Is anything too hard for the Eternal? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. But Sarah denied it, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. Now, I'm not sure she laughed out. Apparently, she didn't laugh out loud, but she laughed internally. Well, see, God can read your thoughts, so you don't have to laugh out loud for God to think that you're being, to know that you're being cynical. You don't have to just laugh out loud. If you laugh internally, he knows. But Sarah denied it, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. And he said, no, but you did laugh. Then the men rose from there and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on the way. All right, so he laughed when he first heard about it. She laughed, at least internally, when she first heard about it. And the son's name was Laughter, so that we always remember that his birth was not only, of course, a great joy, but just unbelievable, a great miracle. And so God used him as a type. And he said, you think that's a miracle? A 90-year-old woman, a 100-year-old man having a son? I'll give you a greater miracle, a virgin having a child. How about that? And so Isaac was a type of Jesus Christ, his descendant, who came through Mary and was, of course, a miraculous birth, as we know, virgin birth. Anyway, then the men rose from there and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on the way. Again, the concept of accompanying the guest out, you know. This is, again, an act of hospitality. When I first dealt with Japanese people, I was very impressed that when we visited them, they would come out and kind of wait outside till we were in our vehicle and off on our way. They would just very formally, just all, you know, if we were visiting them, they would come out with us and see us to our vehicle. Until we were on our way, they remained outside watching us. as if to make sure everything went all right, the car started all right, you know, and we were on our way. Then they went back into their home. And so this is what Abraham does. He accompanies them, you know, on their way. And the Jews have an interesting tradition regarding the Sabbath. When the Sabbath leaves, you know, they have this Saturday night little party to say goodbye to the Sabbath. And they have, you know, refreshments and songs and a sermonette. And, you know, this is probably what was happening with the Apostle Paul in the book of Acts. Of course, in his case, the sermonette went on so long that somebody fell and actually died and had to be miraculously resurrected. But it was probably an event that we call in Hebrew the Malava Malka, accompanying the queen, as you know, saying goodbye to the Sabbath. Anyway, so he accompanied the guests, sent them on their way. Verse 17, and the Eternal said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? Remember what I read in John 15. You know, he was a friend of God, and he was a friend of the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. And so the Logos was going to, you know, tell him what was going to happen. Verse 18, since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him. So it's important that we have a positive influence, not only on our children, but even on our grandchildren and beyond, if we can be. I have a grandson now. I take this seriously. I want to be a good example for my grandchild. And in Abraham's case, we have four generations of righteous men, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, powerful foursome there. For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Eternal to do righteousness and justice, that the Eternal may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. I need to go back. Oh, no, I'm not there yet. I was going to go to Genesis 18:22, but I'll get there. Verse 20. And the Eternal said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, and if you want to know what kind of people they were, you can read Genesis 19. I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me. And if not, I will know. Well, obviously God is omnipotent, but he's giving the Sodomites a chance to perhaps reconsider their behavior. Or he's wanting to make it very plain to everybody what kind of people they were. So he sends these two angels out, you know, undercover men, as it were, to blend in with the environment and see what happens. Well, we know what happens. So, in effect, God, you can't come back to him and say, well, you know, you were being a bit harsh with us. We're not really that bad. Yes, you are that bad. I sent two angels to you and you know, you threatened them, you threatened Lot, you know, and so on. You can read the account. Verse 22, then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Eternal. The Jewish tradition, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, brothers and sisters, the Jewish tradition is that the passage originally said, but the Eternal still stood before Abraham. But the tradition is that the scribes just couldn't write that. It was just too anthropomorphic. Yahweh still stood before Abraham? Ah, that's just so shocking, you know, a picture that they decided to write it as you see here. That's the Jewish tradition. Then the men turned away from there and went towards Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Eternal. So anyway, Abraham is standing with God having a conversation. Could you imagine that? Well, the time will come, you know, but right now this is not the time for us, but it was a time for Abraham to do it. And here Abraham could have said to him, yes, I understand that, but I've got relatives there. Is there any way they could perhaps, you know, be taken care of and not have to go through that? But that's not what he said. He argued for the whole community. So you see his attitude. It was not this attitude of, you know, I want them to get theirs. It was an attitude of being merciful, compassionate on that community. He wasn't just concerned with his own relatives, but with the whole community. And so we have these negotiations. And if you come from the Middle East, a Middle Easterner would enjoy this passage because they're used to the haggling in the marketplace. They're used to the negotiating. You know, and in fact, there's a story about a man who was trying to go undercover in the Arab world. He was not an Arab. I believe he was an Englishman. So he goes to buy some lemonade or juice or something, and he's given the price, and he just pays it to drink the juice. Well, right away, they all pounced on him. You're not an Arab. You know, because an Arab would argue about the price. So anyway, they're having these negotiations here. And evidently, we have, you know, God says, I'm going to go there, or check, you know, and check it out in the form of these two angels. And then we have six steps, you know, 50, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10, where Abraham is negotiating and he gets it down to 10. And, he says he'll even save the city for 10. But of course, well, anyway, let's go to verse 32. So we have seven steps, right? The two angels get sent, and then we have the dickering that gets it down to 10 people. Then he said, this is verse 32. Let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak, but once more is my final offer or plea. Suppose 10 should be found there. You know, what we call in Hebrew now a minyan, a quorum. And he said, I will not destroy it for the sake of the 10. So you see how passionate God is. If he could find 10 righteous people, he would have spared the whole town, but no, or the towns, but no. It didn't work out that way, did it? So the Eternal went his way as soon as he had finished speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. So God, you know, moves on from, just as Christ ascended, you know, in Acts 1, Yahweh moves away from Abraham. So Abraham has a sense that he's not in the same situation as he was previously, and then he goes back to his place. And so then we have the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now if we go to Genesis 21, we'll find that indeed the promise was kept, and this very laughable event actually occurs. You know, 100-year-old man, a 90-year-old woman, to have the child, just as Mary as a virgin had her child, the Christ child. Genesis 21, and the Eternal visited Sarah. This is Genesis 21. So yes, this was a birth that where there was sexual intercourse, but it was still a miracle, obviously, because it was people who normally would be past the age of having of being able to do to have to beget children. You know, the man could not beget a child, nor the woman conceive a child under normal circumstances. And the Eternal visited Sarah as he had said, and the Eternal did for Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, as at the set time which God had spoken to him. So he did it at a certain time to effect enforce the miracle even further. He did it at a certain time, which I would say is the first day of unleavened bread. Right, and then of course later on, of course, they leave Egypt at that time, as you know, as we understand. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Yitzchak. You know, laughter. And of course, then Abraham circumcised his son when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. And Sarah said, God has made me laugh. So now the laughter is not in cynicism, but in joy. And Sarah said, God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me. Not at me. You know, they might have laughed at me if I told them I'm going to become pregnant. They might have laughed at me, but now I've got a son. So now they're going to laugh with me. She also said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? For I have borne him a son in his old age. So the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. So obviously you can just see the celebratory atmosphere here. It reminds me of Psalm 126, which Jews recite on the Sabbath before when they finish a formal meal. It says, this is the beginning of Psalm 126, a song of ascents. When the Eternal brought back the captivity of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter. So that's how the millennium is going to be when Christ returns and restores this world. We're going to be, our mouth will, you know, it says, then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with singing. Then they said among the nations, the Eternal has done great things for them. And then I'll go to the end of the Psalm, or to the fifth verse. Those who sow in tears, S-O-W, though, and not S-E-W, although maybe that fits too. Those who sow in tears shall reap in joy. He who continually goes forth weeping, bearing seed for sowing, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. You know, that old Protestant hymn, bringing in the sheaves, huh? Some of you remember. Anyway, so we have a very joyful occasion here. So this divine visit teaches us a lot of lessons. It teaches us lessons of hospitality. It teaches us God's involvement with us, His mercy. It teaches a proper attitude that we ought to have about this world and our relationship with God. It shows God miraculously worked in human history for His plan of salvation to be fulfilled, that He miraculously gave Abraham and Sarah a child. He miraculously gave Mary, a child. He stepped into human history to bring about His plan of salvation. And what He can do for us is beyond our imagination and our expectations. So let me conclude with what Paul wrote to the Ephesians in Ephesians 3. A summary of this material I've read today can be found if I read this final section of Ephesians 3 and verse 20. As we conclude this discussion of a divine visit to a friend. Ephesians 3:20. Now to Him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us, to Him be glory in the church by Christ Jesus to all generations forever and ever. Amen. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the Bible with people listening. It's nice to have people listening when I talk about the Bible. And I want to let you know that we plan to have Pentecost services. And we'll have them, when the appropriate time occurs. What Sunday was it? June 8th, I believe it is. But it will be at 3 p.m. Eastern time or noon on the West Coast. But the next week, I just want to let you know now, alert you. The next week, that is the week after Pentecost, so that would be, I guess, the 15th of June, we're going to have services on that Sabbath an hour early. We're going to have services on that Sabbath at 11 o'clock Eastern time. In the morning, at 2 o'clock afternoon, 2 p.m. Eastern time in the afternoon, 2 p.m. and 11 a.m. out on the Pacific coast, 11 a.m. Now, I hope that that will not inconvenience you. In fact, I hope that it will make your Sabbath easier. It'll be more convenient for you because once we do it, we're likely to keep that routine. So I would appreciate feedback if anybody feels that that's an oppressive thing, that you really are so happy with the way it is now that 1 hour earlier would be in any way difficult. And don't feel embarrassed if you want to talk about it in a negative way. It's up to you. If you feel 12 is a whole lot better, then let me know. But if 11 is not a problem, or maybe is even better, then let me know. Because we're going to do it, and that'll be the week after Pentecost. And then after that, we may continue if it doesn't create, difficulties for those who want to listen live. Of course, I know many of you who are listening to this are not listening live, so it really isn't a problem to you. Whenever you're listening, we are certainly appreciative of the fact that you are. And we hope and pray that these messages are helpful to you. And we wish you, of course, as we always do, all the best to you and yours.